You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Deborah Palmer. Deborah was just 7 years old when someone would abduct her on her way to school. Her community came out in full force to find her, and when they discovered she was murdered, hundreds in her community mourned the loss of little Deborah. Yet 25 years later, her case remains unsolved. Deborah Palmer grew up in Oak Harbor, Washington. She lived in an apartment complex on Kettle Street with her mother, Madeline, and her little brother, who was 5 at the time. Oak Harbor is a small town located on Whidbey Island that not only has a tight community, but is very diverse due to the Navy base bringing people from all over the world. Those that live in the community say that this is a great place to raise children, with great schools and community support. In 1997, there was a population of around 18,000 residents, give or take a few hundred people. It seems like a pretty cool place to grow up. Deborah was born in the Philippines and brought to Oak Harbor, Washington when she was very little. Why her parents chose Washington and Oak Harbor specifically, I don't know. Deborah's father wouldn't be involved in her life early on. In fact, in 1997, he was serving time in prison for child rape. Deborah's mother at the time wasn't making the best life choices when it came to being a mother. She would say later on that Deborah didn't like the people that she was hanging out with. Deborah's grandmother, Deborah, with whom she shared her name, said little Deborah was so beautiful, but as beautiful as she was just as sweet. She said she was just a little doll. Madeline's ex-boyfriend, Kyle Davis, had been the main caretaker for Deborah and her little brother for a few years, to the point that Deborah and her little brother referred to him as Dad. At the time of Deborah's disappearance, he was living in the same apartment complex, despite him and Madeline being separated. And the day before Deborah's disappearance, he is actually arrested for allegedly raping Deborah's 15-year-old cousin. So when we look at little Deborah's life at this time, there was a lot going on in her little world. Despite the difficulties in her home life, teachers said that Deborah was a really good student. They said she did her homework and assignments to the best of her capabilities, and they truly believed that she would go somewhere in life because despite what was going on at home, she always showed up at school being the best student she could be. On the morning of March 26, 1997, Deborah's 11-year-old cousin would arrive at the apartment on Kettle Street to pick up Deborah, like she did every morning, for them to walk together to school, which was just a few blocks away from the apartment. On this day, however, when her cousin arrived, Deborah wasn't ready for school. She was still in her pajamas. There are different reports on why she wasn't ready that morning, like she was upset or she had slept in. Either way, Deborah's mother, Madeline, would tell her cousin to go ahead and head to school without Deborah. And once Deborah was finished getting ready, she would send her on her way to school. Deborah would eventually get ready and her mother would send her out the front door around 8:30 a.m., dressed in her red jacket that had multicolored stripes and her Esmeralda orange backpack. Madeline had an arrangement with a friend to drop off lunch for Deborah around noon. Madeline's friend would drop off lunch for Deborah, and that would set everything in motion. By 1 p.m., Madeline is informed that her daughter never showed up at school, and no one let her know that she hadn't arrived to school. Side note, there is a system in place in many schools, long before 1997, that dictates if a child does not show up in the morning and is absent, there needs to be a call to the parent or guardian to let them know that the child is absent. That way, things like this don't happen. And it doesn't mean hours before we figure out that a child is missing. That call was not made to Deborah's mother. The school said they decided that she must have been homesick and left it at that. It would be Deborah's first grade teacher, Susan Bridle, that would raise alarms when she was notified that there was a lunch dropped off for Deborah and Deborah wasn't in her class. Her teacher said it was a very bad feeling when they realized Deborah wasn't home either. The police were called immediately and they sprung into action. They created a search team right away. They would bring in bloodhounds on the first day to try to track Deborah's scent. Officers decided to set up roadblocks on Kettle Street because that's the street Deborah took every morning on her way to school. They began pulling over drivers and asking them if they recognized Deborah and had they seen anything suspicious or out of the normal, or had they seen Deborah at all. Along with the police search team, family, friends, neighbors, and people from all over the community jumped in and asked how they could help and began searching everywhere for Deborah. While officers searched and conducted interviews on Kettle Street, detectives began interviewing the family and friends of Deborah. And that's when they realized that the pool of people that they were going to have to question and run down was massive due to Madeline's lifestyle and her apartment complex that they were living in's transient nature. The following day, the lines at the parent drop-off and pickup were long and filled with anxious parents that feared for their children's safety. The community suddenly realized there may be dangers lurking in their neighborhoods that they never considered until their sense of security was suddenly shattered. Parents wanted to get involved and volunteered in the community watch groups, but then parents started to worry about strangers with ill intentions posing as those in the watch group, so they actually made vests to help identify those that were volunteering in each group. Tim Teeters, whose son attended Oak Harbor Elementary, would be found passing out flyers to parents at the schools and on major intersections trying to help spread awareness in the community and for all motorists to be on the lookout for Deborah. Tim said, quote, "We're a small community, and when something like this happens, everyone bands together. I was in shock when I heard about Deborah's disappearance. You hear about this kind of thing happening in the city, but never in a community like this," end quote. It would be the fourth day of the search for Deborah when a search party would discover Deborah's unique red jacket with multicolored stripes and her orange Esmeralda backpack off Taylor Road in a wooded area close to a gravel pit. Search teams and investigators would scour the area of Taylor Road and the wooded area surrounding it looking for Deborah or any more of her belongings, but nothing was found. The following day, day five, Marion Hunsker, a retired fisherman on a private beach near Strawberry Point, several miles east of where Deborah lived, would spot something on the shore under a log. He said at first he thought it was a doll, but as he came closer to inspect the object, he realized it was the body of the missing child whose face he had seen all over town and on the news. He called authorities right away to report it. He would tell reporters years later that he still wakes up in the middle of the night, her face appearing in his dreams. This private beach was not easily accessible, as it is below large bluffs with large homes in a private community. If you were to Google Strawberry Point Homes in Oak Harbor, Washington, you'll see how the houses cascade down the bluffs, and then you'll see the stretch of beach below. This is not an easily accessible area, even by the people who live there. The press would get wind of the discovery of a child's body and they would ascend upon Strawberry Point, causing chaos, not just on the ground, but they were flying helicopters above. It would be Island County Coroner Robert Bishop that would be called down to the scene. Bishop recalls how he, like everyone else, was aware of the search for Deborah, and when the call came in, he dreaded it was her. Bishop told Whidbey News, quote, "I don't think anyone involved has ever forgotten about this case. It haunts you," end quote. Bishop believed that Deborah's body was deposited by the waves onto the shore. It was impossible on the scene and later in the autopsy to determine her exact time of death. It was really hard to pinpoint. Bishop was able to determine that she had been in the water for at least 24 hours. There would be a helicopter needed to come transport Deborah's body from the beach. The news helicopters above were already creating so many waves in the water that when the transport helicopter came down even closer to pick up Deborah and Bishop to transfer them to the vehicle where they could take Deborah's body to the funeral home for her autopsy, the waves became so massive across the beach that Bishop picked up little Deborah's body and held her tightly until they were able to board the helicopter. It's something he says he will never forget. I say this for two reasons. One, to understand exactly how hard it is to get down to this beach from these bluffs. The second reason I bring it up is to point out how the media can unintentionally cause more chaos at a crime scene than there needs to be. There's a great article where Bishop talks about that day and being on that beach and what it was like to have all these reporters all over the place and how that can really hinder their investigation and the work they're trying to do in the moment sometimes. Deborah's body would be transported to Burley's funeral home, where her autopsy would be performed. The amount of press and onlookers on the road once the helicopter landed was again chaos. To be able to get Bishop and Deborah in a vehicle to head towards the funeral home, additional officers would be called in and they would make almost a funeral procession line of vehicles pushing forward through the traffic and all the chaos to get little Deborah and Bishop to the funeral home. The cause of death would be ruled homicide by asphyxiation, and Bishop came to the conclusion that she most likely died at least a day after being kidnapped. They were able to determine there were no signs of sexual assault, but were not ruling out sexual motivation for her abduction and murder. Investigators wouldn't release any details on why they were positive that she hadn't been strangled, but do share with the local media that strangulation wasn't the cause. Bishop would say while Deborah's body was clothed when they found her, there were still articles of clothing unaccounted for. The following day, April 2nd, 1997, hundreds in the community would gather in Oak Harbor High School auditorium to hear what investigators had to say about the now known homicide of Deborah and the threat to their community and the children of their community. The police chief at the time, Tony Barge, was honest with the parents, telling them he couldn't give them that type of assurance. Chief Barge said, quote, "We don't know if it's someone living in the community," end quote. He went on to explain that this was going to be a long investigation and that they were going to need parents and those in the community to band together and keep a closer eye on the children and pay attention to things that seem unusual, like cars loitering in the area where children hang out. The FBI would help the Island County Sheriff's Department by giving them software that could help them maintain the amount of tips that were coming in and properly sort the information in a way that allowed investigators to run down each lead in a timely manner. In those first days and weeks, hundreds of tips came pouring in. When it came down to it, investigators honestly couldn't answer the question of where Deborah was abducted from. They could account for Deborah with her mother, Madeline, in the apartment till around 8:30 a.m. in the morning. But after she walked out that door, they don't even know if she made it out of the apartment complex or to the street to be abducted. They don't feel confident that they could say for sure which one. Chief Barge pleaded with the public to please think back now that they've had some time to absorb everything that's happened. There must have been a minimum of 15 motorists that would have passed Deborah on Kettle Street at 8:30 in the morning. If she took her usual path on her way to school, and if she was on that street, they would have had to have seen something. He said no motorists during the time in the morning have come forward to say anything to officers despite their pleas to come forward. The day Deborah was abducted, when officers were stopping motorists on Kettle Street, two witnesses would state that they saw Deborah on her way to school that morning at 8:30 a.m., but don't report seeing anyone else or any cars stopping by her. A memorial service would be held Saturday after Deborah's body was found, and over 300 mourners would pour into the Oak Harbor High School auditorium once again, but this time to pay respects to Deborah and her family. Classmates sang songs and her family members read heartfelt eulogies expressing their deep pain at the tragic loss of Deborah. Deborah Palmer Sr. said in her eulogy, quote, "I know you touched the hearts of many in this world of such cruelty, yet no one did you touch more than your mother, and of course me," end quote. The apartment where Deborah lived and the playground that she played at would be filled with letters, cards, teddy bears, flowers, heart balloons, and so much more. So many people in the community came and wanted to leave something in memory of Deborah. At this point, the Naval Criminal Investigative Services was helping on the case, but despite community involvement, help from the FBI, and the Navy, tips would slow down in the coming weeks and months. Chief Barge would say he didn't know if this killer was just passing through or if they were someone that lived amongst them in their community. He was shocked to see the apathy in this community as the months went on. 7 weeks after Deborah's disappearance, Chief Barge would tell local reporter Linda Keene, quote, "It's very discouraging. Shortly after Deborah's disappearance, parents were back in their routines of letting kids walk alone on the bus stops or at schools in remote county areas. They presumed that the monster came through the community, killed Deborah, and left." End quote. Madeline would sink into a deep depression, and she began drinking daily just to cope. She drank to numb the pain and wanted to leave Oak Harbor because the memory of Deborah was everywhere. But her son, who already lost so much and was grieving his sister's loss, didn't want to leave and lose his community too, and everything he knew. So Madeline stayed. Madeline said she knew everyone blamed her for Deborah's death, and she blamed herself as well. She would come out years later telling reporters that she was young at the time and she made lots of mistakes, but that she loved her daughter, and losing her deeply affected her. She said that while she understood their blame, they didn't understand that this ate at her every day. She didn't want to live anymore. She didn't know why she was here and what she was doing. As the years went on, investigators didn't have suspects or answers about her daughter's disappearance. Madeline would turn that energy and focus to work. She would end up working two jobs, one at a plant and one at a nursing home. Still now, she says that she would have worked 24/7 if she could, because that is the only time she escapes the horrors in her mind. Madeline can't bear to go back to the cemetery to visit Deborah's grave, but she does know that many do go visit and bring Deborah fresh flowers. In the wake of Deborah's death, her little brother was only 5 and couldn't understand the full scope of the tragedy that was unfolding around him. All he knew was his sister that he went to for everything was gone, and his mother was emotionally and mentally checked out, and he was left to figure out all these very big emotions and this massive life-altering event all on his own. Deborah's grandmother, Deborah, would say that losing Deborah took something from her. After Deborah's death, she was so closed off from the rest of her family emotionally. She said that when she found out that Deborah was murdered, she felt like she was actually going to die. The loss of that sweet little girl had a massive ripple effect not only on her community, but for her family, a ripple effect that still they feel today. In 2005, a well-known serial killer, and child serial killer specifically, would be potentially linked to Deborah's abduction and murder, since this man sexually assaulted, abducted, and murdered other children in the area. He had stolen his girlfriend's car and was in Washington around the time of Deborah's abduction. However, Detective Gardner would be able to prove definitively years later that it was impossible for him to have anything to do with Deborah's murder because at the exact same time Deborah was abducted, this man was taking a polygraph test in Seattle. I won't be using his name because it takes away from Deborah's case, and not only does it take away from Deborah's case, but it takes away from his known victims, and that's not what we're here to do. If you're interested in that side of the story, I will have articles and sources linked below that touch back to that investigation and how they ruled him out. Deborah's case would go cold, and 13 years after her murder, a new detective would be assigned to her case, and Bishop would come forward saying that he does believe that evidence collected at the scene will help solve this case. Detective Gardner would become the lead detective in Deborah's case in 2010. In 1997, she was a patrol officer who had no involvement in Deborah's case at the time. Since 1997, she has worked her way up to become a detective specializing in sex crimes and crimes against children. She says looking back now, she believes that the police department may have been overwhelmed with the investigation because nothing like this had ever happened in Oak Harbor before. Detective Gardner's hope 13 years later was that time had passed and maybe people were scared to say something in the beginning, were now willing to come forward because relationships change as time goes on. Maybe someone in the community had slipped up and said something. Maybe somebody just needed to come forward with that information. In the 13 years since the initial investigation, advancements in science had come lightning years ahead. And now Detective Gardner was sending some evidence to the Washington State Crime Lab to be tested. At the time, she said she was particularly interested in new touch DNA testing, but she would not divulge what evidence was sent in for testing. At the time, in March 2010, she told local reporters that she was still waiting on results. Detective Gardner would go on to say over the years, they have looked into local sex offenders to see if they have anything to do with Deborah's case, as well as crimes all across the country that have similarities in Deborah's case. And still, they haven't made any connection to any other crimes, or have they been able to come forth with a suspect. Again, Deborah's case wouldn't see any movement, and in April of this year, now 25 years later, investigators are saying they are still waiting on evidence that they recently submitted to be tested. I don't know what the results from Detective Gardner's submitting evidence in 2010 was, and I don't know what new evidence was submitted recently, and what their term of recently means, since they aren't giving us an update with specifics like, we submitted this year or resubmitted a few months ago. They're just saying recently. Captain Mike Bailey would say that Detective Lisa Powers would take over the case after Gardner and that she put everything she had into that case and trying to reinvigorate the investigation. He would say that the detectives Power and Gardner immersed themselves in Deborah's case. Before Powers left their department, she spent the last year digitizing Deborah's case and reorganizing the documents and report in Deborah's case into 25 large ring binders. Captain Bailey would tell local reporters that the Attorney General Homicide Tracking System has also offered in helping Deborah's case in recent years. Captain Bailey says that he has to admit that changes in their department have affected Deborah's case. Investigators have come and gone, and every time you put a new investigator on that case, it takes it in a different direction. Only him and one other fellow captain have stayed at the department throughout the years after Deborah's murder. Captain Bailey says at this time, Deborah's case still remains unsolved, and while no suspect has ever been identified, several persons of interest have been contacted and spoken to throughout the years. It's 25 years later, multiple investigators later, and Deborah's community has long moved on. But not Deborah's mother, brother, and grandmother, and so many other loved ones haven't, and they deserve answers. Deborah was just 7 years old, and her life was stolen, and somebody has to answer for that. Please share Deborah's story in whatever format you feel comfortable, because Deborah's case needs a spotlight. It needs hope breathed back into it. If you have any information regarding the abduction and murder of Deborah, please contact the Oak Harbor Police Department at 360-679-8447. There is a $3,500 reward for information leading to an arrest or conviction in this case. Thank you again for listening. And if you're on Apple or Spotify, please hit that subscribe button or leave a review. I would love to hear from you, my listeners. Leave a review on Apple or Spotify telling me where you're from and what you like about this podcast, and I'll read your review at the end of the episodes. I can't wait to hear from you. As with all the cases I cover, the sources and informative links will be listed on my website as well as the show notes. Unfortunately, I was not able to find many pictures of Deborah, but I will be sharing the ones that I was able to find. Don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.